that I had been in love with the idea of Titch Bobsey, his Jaguar, his wife, his children tumbling across the grass in the middle of the night. Her husband is my friend. Clover's upper lip contracted, and I was moved to place my finger there, on that entrancing mole. She wished I wouldn't. "Your beauty mark," I said, as she removed my hand. "It is a mark of sin, according to my mother. It's certainly persuasive." "No, it's not funny." "Your sin?" "I told my mother, if it's not my sin, it must be yours." She slapped my face. "Ha! Exactly." I thought, what unknown winds have delivered our spirits to our bodies? "Come on," she said, "it's time." "Time for what?" As we rose from the booth, I thought, you do not know her. You will say you love her because of something brainless, like a lovely clavicle. "Bones," I thought, as we entered the darkness of Gisborne Road, up the hill where the air was damp and cool and smelled of rotting leaves and the excretions of cattle and attendant horses who had recently passed that way. Mare urine is an aphrodisiac for stallions, so Ben Calvo says. He owes his cafe to his knowledge of racecourse matters, so perhaps this will prove true. The doors of the chemist shops had been locked, but we walked as if they were open to our desire, arm in arm, and by the Church of England graveyard, where we stopped to kiss. Sex makes a man dishonest with himself, as is well known. I feared the slippery ambiguity of false feeling, of expediency, of things not being exactly true. We entered the front gate of my house and squeezed down the side by the hydrangeas, and I smelled her soft neck, imagining rooms and places beyond my life. In the smudgy dark, I spied my sleeping chooks, chalky lumps up on the roof. "I'll clip their wings," she said, "before I go." Once inside, I was deaf with worry about the chemists and my disfigured shoulder. I drew blinds and curtains everywhere, and she smiled at me, and I wished she would not see my awful scar. She kicked off her shoes. I could not imagine what she thought. Say we were in Italy. What then? In the kitchen we embraced, and she held me close, and breathed my breath, and said that was how you know a person was right. She was so lithe and exceptionally beautiful and gentle, and with her hands clasped around my shoulder blades, she pulled herself up into my life. I said we could not do what we both wished. That's for the girl to say. Not without a thing. You've got a very nice thing, as far as I can feel. Then my veins and arteries were full to bursting, but I'd rather kill myself than play this game. Then we were on the bedroom floor, among the books, like teenagers, and I said, outright, plainly, the problem was the absence of the contraceptive. She said there were lots of ways to skin a cat, but she did not understand I was who I was, because, once upon a time, I had been a boy. I had spurted in a second like a sparrow. I spilled my seed, but not upon the ground. I trusted my secrets to those glistening, observant eyes. I confessed. Adelina Koenig and I had been just 20 years old when she got pregnant and we ran away to Melbourne. I had assumed we would have the baby there. It was Adelina, the nurse, who found the abortionist. I did not know such men existed. Poor children, Clover said. How awful. What a lot of money you had to find. I was touched she would accept my ugly secrets. I confessed that I had borrowed the money from Sebastian Lasky, who I didn't know well enough to ask so much of, but who would, more than once, descend into the wreckage of my life to save me. "You're an attractive man," she said. "You will always be forgiven." She helped me remove my shirt, and there was no choice but to reveal the scar, that brutal wound like a fissure in a concrete slab. She licked it, as deep as she could go. She loved me. She said so. She sucked my nipples like I was a girl. I moaned. I thought, the power of sex cannot be denied, stopped or plugged. It is as insistent as water leaking through a roof, finding its way in darkness, emerging in the back seat of a car. There was nothing to be frightened of. She said, no, I thought. Only what it makes you do, clawing at the trees, splintering the bark like a tomcat, the blind and violent need of it, a joy. But who would not want to be relieved of it? I pity the Catholic priests, suffering their sex, the stream of desire finding its way to the ocean without regard to good or evil. And if it ends up as evil, then that is the relentless nature of it. The cat was flayed alive. Hours later, still on the floor, we talked and talked, kissed and cried, and my wound must be examined, and my tumble from the kitchen window lived again, and Adelina Koenig also must be described. It means king, she said. I know. But you must have had another baby. That's why you're hiding from the summonses now. He turned out not to be my child. Any moment I thought, she will not love me any more. How could anyone be certain he wasn't your son? Just say the baby was red-headed and that my wife was not. I could see she was about to argue, and I would not tolerate it. And there was a red-haired bloke who was always at your house. What did Adelina say? I wished she wouldn't use her name. You left her, is that correct? You don't understand, I said, but I saw her face and it was clear she did. Poor Willie. I'm sure she suffered, and he suffered too, the poor little blighter. How old are you, Willie? 26. You're too young for all this guilt. See, look, you're ready. In self-defence, I summoned an urgent interest in my grandmother's coloured atlas of the Holy Roman Empire. I laid it before her, and she admired it, and listened to my unshakable belief that I did not belong where my mother had delivered me. I had no reason to be in the hot streets of wartime Adelaide, not when my true home must be in the atlas of the Habsburg Empire and the lands of Hungary. There was no map of Adelaide that could produce the longing aroused by the dense, fibrous universe of that atlas, which, being hand-painted in a slightly unconventional, if not eccentric, manner, had the mellow colours of a closely woven Persian rug, in which our red Hungary had turned a greyish-brown. Salzburg was the colour of dried straw. Croatia was pale pink. Bohemia, like the other states, was now foxed and speckled brown. The crumbling coast of Dalmatia in the south was what I believe is known as spectrum violet. But of course, dear man, she herself had not belonged in Dandenong. There was her gorgeous silk-skinned leg, folded beneath her dark private hair, glistening with dew. And here were all of these lands with their diverse peoples, Germans, Magyars, Spanish Jews, Romanies, and Mohammedans, which had been a source of wonder to my childish imagination. My grandmother told me that an ancestor of ours, a Venetian nobleman, had been called to advise the Imperial Council in Vienna. What he had done there, or what became of him, we could never know. But he was the reason that I had curiously splayed Italian toes, and although blonde-haired, as my father the pastor, would turn brown as a Mediterranean berry in the Australian sun. Likewise, Clover was olive-skinned, but did not know, she told me, where she came from. She thought her grandfather had been in a poem by Wordsworth, perhaps in Troutbeck, and she had read compulsively but never found either poem or boy. Her grandmother was a real Cockney, in Bow, but the address on her birth certificate had been bombed to dust in the Second World War. There were olive-skinned Scots and Irish, she supposed. Her great-grandmother had hated De Valera because he would not take off his hat to the Prince of Wales. She had a magpie history, bright pebbles with no bedrock. We know nothing. It is l'état australien, she said. Think about the red-headed child. What might he ever know of how he came to be? I told her the father was an American nurse at the Royal Melbourne Hospital. He had been our friend. He was a good nurse, I thought, a good friend, I had imagined. And fucked your wife, she said. Dear God, how could I defend myself from that brutality? You should have killed him, she said, playing with my toes, rumpling the maps. Who knows what murderers we descend from? You will expect me to be repulsed by this, and yet this imaginary murder was an expression of passion, an expression of support, of love, a renewal of unresolved desire, and Lord, well, never mind. She drew a fine wet thread from my sex, and there was more than one way to skin the cat, and the walls were thin, and I did not care how she snorted or shouted out to God. When we finally rose from the floor, the Holy Roman Empire was in shreds, and, for the moment anyway, I really did not care.
Chapter 16. When my husband told me he was off to see a man about a dog, I assumed it was somehow related to the show-off Red X trial. It did not occur to me, not for a moment, that after all I had said, after all he had said, he was going back to Ford to try again. It was predictable, of course. This was how he was with his father, always going back to take another beating. It was morning. Edith was in strife for handing in a drawing in which all the kids were purple. No one wears purple, the teacher had said. She was allegedly old and crabby, and Edith was Edith. She had just pointed out that Barbara Radford had purple stripes in her sweater. Her teacher said Barbara Radford did not have a purple face. Edith did not wish to go to school. Ronnie was stamping around the house. Roundy bouty, as he liked to say. He had never had real boots before, and he was mad with happiness, rushing outside to break the ice in the puddles and tramp mud back across the carpet. I walked them hand in hand to school. I returned intending to make a trunkline call to learn what Dunstan had said to Titch and what Titch had said to him. At home, I discovered there had been a chicken massacre next door. Huge white flowers, dead mounds of dusters, dead as dodos, and in the midst of all this sudden death in his veggie garden, wearing a woolen beanie in Bacchus March colours, stood Mr. Buck Hooper, grasping a dead creature to his chest. "We cut their wings," he said. On their first flightless morning, his chickens had been visited by next door's Cocker Spaniel. I don't see this was my fault, although I felt it. I did not ask him who was we. Titch was meanwhile travelling at 93 miles an hour towards new humiliation. I was at home, busy on the phone with Dunstan. I asked him why he had given in about the Red X. He needs something to look forward to, Dunstan said. Wasn't a dealership enough, I asked. He laughed. In Geelong, the big noises asked my husband what he was doing back with no appointment.
I have the capital, he said. That's nice, mate. Plus, I am going to win the Red X trial. Yes, but we have the franchise allocated, all signed up. Unsign him. Mate, no one can match my sales numbers.
Why was it, they asked him, that salesmen always imagined they were the centre of the universe? This was not so. The Ford Motor Company required a Bacchus Marsh dealer with business acumen, as they called it, plus substantial capital, marketing know-how, promotional capability, real estate experience. Salesmen were a dime a dozen. Titch was not offended. He said so. He had been insulted by experts in the past. If a dealership was impossible, then he would make it possible. Doubtless he annoyed them, shouting, not knowing that his power was no longer what it was.
"Give me a chance," he said. "I've got the capital."
To tell the truth, his capital was not enough. Also, he might as well hear it from them. There was the problem of confusion about Bob's motors.
What confusion? Your old man has opened up outside of Melton.
No, he hasn't.
Yes, he has.
Opened what?
A motor business.
I can see his mouth, poor darling.
Well, what of it?
Branding, they said, a new word that had to be explained.
We can't deal with two Bob's Motors. Can't do it. When you see the place, you'll understand.
Of course it didn't matter that Dan had gone and opened up his own used car business on the Melbourne Road. But it mattered to my husband. In fact, it winded him.
Sorry, Titch.
He should have come home to me. Instead, he rushed off to chat to his tormentor. 43 minutes later, he found the one-hoist garage with Bob's for Ford in fluorescent orange. Of course Dan had no franchise, never had and never could. He was a crummy second-hand car dealer, with one vehicle and the deposit written in whitewash on its windscreen.
"Why are you doing this to me?"
Titch asked. The answer was, the mongrel couldn't help himself. He took his well-dressed son around the back, where, beside the battery shed, he showed him a propeller rescued from the Dali tip.
"After all I did for you," he said.
Chapter 17. I was emotional, yes, but not in the way Mrs. Bobsey imagined. How could I have told her that even as I dug the graves I was happy? I was loved. I loved in turn. It was all I ever wanted. That was the immoral truth I could never tell a soul. I drove the spade deep, cutting off my own potatoes, and all the time I thought of Clover, those unflinching eyes bright behind her lashes, her tennis player's legs drawing me in deeper. I stood my spade against the side wall of the house. I washed my hands. I scrubbed the floor and made the bed. I swept the front veranda and burned the legal letters demanding child support. I saved only the envelope marked the Education Department of the State of Victoria. This I read as I dressed for the recording session. Dear blah blah blah. As you have failed to appear as requested, the tribunal has no choice but to suspend you without pay as of the date of the offence. Should you wish to appeal this decision, you may present a sequestered defence at the meeting December 10th, 1953. What was a sequestered defence? I didn't care. I wished only to return to Clover and the studio. And what a quiz show we recorded there. A dance, in fact, floating in a field of jasmine and orange blossom. Deasy must have dealt the yellow cards, but I hardly noticed him. It was not until the final minutes that I became aware of his ferocious stare. Had he been looking like that all through the show? Perhaps. But he was a strange man with a peculiar past and wide rings on his large fingers, and I had never tried to really understand him. When Baby Deasy rewound the tape, Deasy invited me out for tea. That is, he pinched the sleeve of my jacket and, with no farewell to frowning Clover, tugged me down the stairs, all the way up Collins Street, not slowly either, dragging me up Spring Street and through the grand doors of the Hotel Windsor. The waitress asked Deasy would he like scones and clotted cream. "No scones," he said, "tea." "And you, sir?" "He'll have tea," said Deasy, and chewed at his moustache until the waitress departed. "Did you root her?" he said. "What? Root! Fuck! Bang! Did you stoop her?" He showed his big teeth and nodded his head ferociously. "You did, didn't you?" I thought, what gives you the right to speak to me like this? "Strike me lucky," he said. "I never saw a fuck so public. She's lost her spark. You have too. If I was a sponsor, I'd take me advertising budget somewhere else. Jesus, Willie, don't shit in your own nest. Not now." I thought, I am not your dog. "This is meant to be a contest," he hissed. "We don't fix the questions. That's the point. Neither of you know what's going to happen next. You want to destroy her, or did you forget? She wants to kill you. That's the point. That's why we cast her." Frankly, I thought he'd gone cuckoo, with his great hands enclosing a soft pack of unfiltered cigarettes, crumbling tobacco onto the Windsor's white tablecloth. "What are you looking at? This?" He held the pack, pinching it between thumb and forefinger. "What is it?" "Philip Morris cigarettes." "Do you know the slogan?" he asked. His eyes were far too bright. "Nothing to lose but your smoker's cough." "Yes." He stared at me with eyebrows raised dramatically. "What would you say to a national quiz show called Nothing to Lose?" "They're signing on. I am this close. Nothing to Lose, brought to you by Philip Morris." "We're going to have to record today's show again. I can't play them this lovey-dovey bullshit." "There'll be real prize money. Real check. Real money you can put in the bank. We'll re-record on Wednesday, okay? You want to kill her. Comprenez-vous? You want a job?" "Yes," I said, but frankly I wasn't certain any more. "Well, piss off," I thought. Poor monster, sick with greed. It was cold and drizzly on Spring Street, but there she was, my darling, tucked into a dark doorway in her bright red overcoat. You waited, but of course. I thought, she will wish to know what Deasy said to me. I was relieved when she did not. Her nose was cold and her mouth was warm, and we bought 2 tuppenny fares on the 15 tram, and soon, minutes later, we were entering a Queen's Road apartment building. Perhaps you know the type, always divided by a long, thin garden path, punctuated by blind white statues and melancholy topiary. One of those Spanish-style blocks which had previously seemed so lost and loveless to me. We entered chastely, brother and sister, as far as all the world could see. Then the door was closed and locked, and never mind the rest. Afterwards, Clover asked me if I was pleased to have my feathers clipped, and I said nothing about the murders. I told her that I loved her, and proved it once again. We lay on musky sheets redolent of jasmine, with her hair curling upon my chest. She kissed my nose. She had discovered Adelina was living in Paran. She had seen her, she said, and my son as well. Another man might have been alarmed, but I trusted jealousy. "She's in the phone book, sweetie. Your red-haired boy," she said. "Oh, poor, poor Willie." Thus she spoke to me in a code, and I could now trust her absolutely. She knew now, certainly, my true history, and she showed me how she accepted my disastrous past. I lay drowsily in the perfumed bed and watched, with the pride and vanity of ownership, her slender, athletic body, as she moved around her tiny kitchen and then brought me mushrooms on toast, and I kissed her earthy, buttery mouth, at once so strange and so familiar. Why would I ever want to kill her? I would rather lose to her, in fact. We moved from mushrooms to sparkling Rheingold. In vino veritas, by golly, only half a glass. We discussed our savings, the cost of life in Italy. I was a balloonist cutting loose the ballast, and with every slash I rose until I was once again a teenager who might become anything he wished. I told her that we had a sponsor. Somehow she already knew. We agreed we would spend weekends together. I returned to Bacchus Marsh with no one to tell me how to spend my time. The education department had lost all power over me, and yet, like many men who find themselves unemployed, I could not be idle. Now, each day, I would arrive in Melbourne just after noon and enter the State Library of Victoria when Sebastian Lasky was at lunch. That is, I would not face the map librarian just yet, or justify my inexplicable occupation. And as he never manned the desk and stayed in his office above Little Lonsdale Street, I was able to call for maps of the pastoralist properties, which lay like a lethal patchwork on top of the true tribal lands. Here, beneath Norman G. Peebles' gorgeous dome, I was at peace, transcribing the coordinates of the famous properties of Deanside and Rockbank. It was a map of murder, of course. What else was I to do? In Bacchus Marsh, I removed an entire wall of books and tacked tracing paper on the plaster. My dining room became a bombsite of homeless volumes, a destruction that permitted the future to exist. We re-recorded. What a show! Clover attacked me, and Deasy was beside himself. He was an auctioneer, conductor of the Philharmonic, a prancing villain in a cloak. Then, as he had promised, we signed real contracts. When that was done, I sat in the control booth while Clover recorded the first commercials. Nothing to lose but your smoker's cough. Oh, Lord, she had the voice for it. Do I root her? Deed I do. Now we did shows with real prizes, the checks all cleared. I spent my weekends in sweet tumescence, my weekday afternoons in the library, and on the road to Cororoit, where the guards at the ICI factory had recovered from their early panic and obtained permission to guide me to certain trees whose bark, they believed, had been used by Aboriginals to make canoes. Being so occupied with my own happiness, I saw little of the Bobsies, and I only learned of their own adventures when Mrs. called on me. "Cough, cough," she cried, knocking on my kitchen door. "Nothing to lose." They had heard me on the radio, she told me. They were so proud to know a famous person. Her excitement was not solely the product of my own success. She and her husband were now Holden dealers, or almost. They were planning to be heroes of the Reckless Red X trial. Imagine that. Around the whole continent, followed by newsreel cameras and photographers. I revealed my ignorance of matters Red X, and she was happy to educate me. The Quotidian brands, Ford, Holden, Plymouth, would take on a gladiatorial persona, armoured against bulls and kangaroos. They would be sticking ugly decals all over a brand new car. Castrol Oil, SPC, Lucas Battery. They would have Bob's Motors written right along one side. She had to go to the solicitors. "Cough, cough," she said. "Bye-bye." I set off to bicycle to Cororoit Creek with my notebook. The wind was at my back as I sailed down the highway, giving myself entirely to this symbolism. For almost 10 miles I flew, until on the long plain near Exford, just where those inexplicable foreign cactus plants grow in the corner of that sheep paddock, my bloody tire was punctured, and I fell and grazed my knee. But even then my luck was good, for I had come to ground exactly opposite a motor garage that seemed to have been freshly decorated for my arrival. Here I found a single Caltex petrol pump, a two-tone Ford Custom line, violent yellow paint splashed everywhere about the concrete forecourt. bold whitewash had been applied excitedly to the windscreen of the Ford. Low deposit, finance available. As I approached, an old man emerged from the office carrying a ball hammer. He wore heavily oil-stained boots and was disguised by a pale grey shop coat. When his thin white hair lifted in the wind, I recognised the famous aviator. "It's you, Jimmy," he said. When I didn't immediately follow him around the corner, he turned. "You need me to carry you?" Thus I beheld what had been hidden from my view, the eastern day-glow wall with red letters taller than a man, Bob's Motors. Here also was a tap and hose, a big steel bath of the type used to locate air leaks, an air compressor and a battery shed against which leaned the propeller Mrs. Bobsey had so cruelly amputated. "Come here, Jimmy, hold this." He already had the front wheel off my bicycle. The tyre was just as swiftly liberated. He called for the air hose and inflated the tube, and, not without a grunt, kneeled to submerge it in the tank. We watched the air bubbles escape the puncture while the westerly wind whipped dust across our faces. Looking at his stern countenance, I thought of Boreas, the god of wind, the sometimes violent old man with a billowing cloak. In the case of Boreas, it was said he had snakes instead of feet. "There you are," he said. "I suppose you've got your own repair kit." "Sorry." He did not criticise me for my lack, and yet, when he disappeared into the battery shed, I felt myself severely judged. He returned without explanation and set to work, drying the tube, washing it with petrol, marking the leak with a white X, and clamping a small black device to the wound. He threw me a box of matches. "Make yourself useful," he said. I lit the match and held it to the patch, startled to see the conflagration thus instigated, like a fuse on fire, hissing, sputtering, dancing around the device. "That's a vulcanizing patch. Did you know that?" "No." "I thought you were a schoolteacher, Jimmy." "I'm Willie." "I know who you are," he said. "You think I would forget you?" He draped the snaky tube across the seat, and while the vulcanizer cooled, we stood with our backs to the vast sign, gazing out across the volcanic plain. The tarpaulins on the passing trucks cracked like sails in a storm, but the wider view was blocked by the battery shed against which the amputated propeller continued to cause unhappiness. Of course, it had been a beautiful piece of design. It had been maliciously damaged. I could not help but feel guilty for my part in that. "How's my boy?" he asked at last. He held me with his rheumy grey eyes. "I missed the little bugger." "I think they're okay now," I said. "I heard he ran off to GM, going to sell Holden's." "They seem happy." "Do they now? You never drove a Holden." "I'm not a driver, no." "Yes, I know that. I had a fellow in here yesterday, Jim Woodall, from out on Long Forest Road. I said to him, 'How's the Holden handling?' You might not know this, Jimmy, but with the light weight in the rear end of a Holden, the handling can get a little hairy. Jim said he had been exceptionally unhappy with the handling, but then he laid a couple of bags of cement dust directly over the rear axle. That almost did the trick. So then he thought, why not? So he took out the rear seat and filled up the well with cement, gravel, water, like he was laying a garden path. When it was set hard, he put the rear seat back, and Bob's your uncle." "You might pass that on to little Titch," said Dangerous Dan, as if he were about to smile. "He might pass that on to GM if he wants to make a living." "Woodall bought a Ford last week, and by the same token," he said, "does he have any bloody idea of how he's going to feed himself?" "I believe so. They seem happy." "Happy? with Miss Lesby Friends. Did you clock the way she dresses? They're going in some race. There's big excitement in the camp. What race would that be? Not the Red X. That's the one, I think. What a circus. Dan ground his cigarette into the ground. How could they afford that? Perhaps I'm wrong. In a Holden? I think so. Think? I'm almost certain, yes. Dan picked up the tube without a word. He's not a driver's bootlace, he said. He looked to me. I kept my counsel. He inflated the tyre and flung it into the bath. Do you think you can manage to put it back together? Do you have a couple of tyre levers I could borrow? Borrow? He stared at me. Sorry. It's a piece of shit, he said, producing the tyre levers from his coat pocket, the F.J. Holden. Thank you, Mr. Bobbs. A GM helping him financially? I don't know. Whose idea was this? Who did this to my propeller? You knew what you were looking at when you first saw it. You knew its value. I know you did. So tell me, Jimmy, can you imagine what a father feels? I'm the one who raised him. Don't ask about the mother. Don't ask what it cost. Years of sacrifice thrown back in my face. I keep the prop here so everyone can see what I put up with. People are shocked. People who thought they knew him. They thought they liked good old Titch. But then they look at this. Good luck to them, said Dan. And I saw he was once more talking of the Bobbsies. How can they go in the bloody Red X trial and have two children? Don't tell me Ms. Lesby Friends will stay behind. I don't know. Here, give me that bloody wheel. I thought, why is everyone suddenly speaking to me like this? He fitted the tube and brought it to its proper pressure with the air hose. Listen to that. You hear that? That's the compressor. They call it free air, he said bitterly. They come in here, don't want to buy any petrol. Can I just have some free air? Listen to the compressor. Does that sound free to you? Go root yourself, I thought. I smiled. How much do I owe you, Mr. Bobbs? I'm a Ford dealer, he said, although this was not true. Yes. Come back, he said. Tell your friends. I suffered his handshake and set off towards my original destination, blown forward on the gusting wind. But the further I went, the more I thought of how this benevolence would turn to punishment when it was time to get back home. I turned and came once more past Bob's Motors, with my head down low, my bum high, my legs in agony already. There, beside the Caltex pump, was Boreas, bringer of winter, the devouring one with his gown billowing. What a miracle was Titch, I thought, to rebound against that force.
Chapter 18. At tea time every Friday, we Bobs gathered around our wireless and listened to the quiz and ate toasted cheese sandwiches and were very pleasantly livid that the dumb high school had fired our famous neighbour. He was a Jebius, as Ronnie said. But who would have guessed it to see how he lived? His narrow weatherboard cottage was sad as suicide. The roof was rusting, its paint peeling. There was no sign of fame visible from the street. And in person he was just a bachelor with old-fashioned bicycle clips to keep his trousers from catching in the chain. You might see him in the cart buying butter, or pushing his Malvern Star up the Gull Street hill, or trundling a wheelbarrow full of manure he had collected from the sale yards. He was top-heavy in the chest and shoulders, and although shorts revealed a pair of thin and boyish legs, he would, in normal costume, have been mistaken for a labourer from the brickworks. But when Titch took the trouble to add up all his winnings, it was clear our next-door neighbour must be a wealthy man. I was sorry when he began to spend weekends away from us, in Melbourne with his fiancée, as he called her. Who was she? When we heard Bob Deasy, "Now knock that off, you kids," we guessed that Miss Cloverdale was his intended. Barcuba was our neighbour, but we knew him better on the wireless, and nothing to lose was our family entertainment and our education. It was why we invested in that dictionary and fought for its possession. "He hogs it, Mum. He can't spell cat," etc. If anyone ever wondered why a person of Titch's education might say, "It's a cardinal error," it was from his study of that dictionary. Ubiquitous was another word from there. He brought the dictionary into our bed, and I was often awoken when it slipped from his grasp and exploded on the floor. I loved the dictionary in spite of this, but I was fascinated by the competition between the man and woman on the quiz show. Deasy clearly favoured Buck Hooper. He was the king. I was never one of those who wished him to lose his crown, but fair is fair. I was dying for Miss Honeyvoice to get a break. I will not say Bob Deasy taunted her, but he certainly brought out something in her opponent, lovely as he was, that suggested it was his man-born right to win. "You better marry that fiancée," I thought. "She is every bit as smart as you." I barracked for Miss Cloverdale so loud my family teased me for it. When I noticed her questions getting harder than his, I said so. For example, in what year did Australia have an inland sea? Miss Cloverdale's answer was 60,000 years ago, before the land was invaded by humans from the direction of New Guinea. What clever children they will have, I thought. But no, her answer triggered one of these dreadful-sounding effects, a slow creaking noise, then an explosion, like a tree crashing to the earth. "Mum," protested Edith. "Mum, they're ganging up on her."
"Wrong answer," Titch cried.
I did not see why he should be so happy.
"What says the king?" cried Deasy. "The correct date is 1827.
Bob Deasy's voice was so happy, I hated him.
"What do you say, listeners? Is it yes or is it no? Australia with an inland sea. Get on the blower. Give us a tingle. You've got nothing to lose."
"Call them," Edith begged me. But we were not rich and would never make a trunkline call for fun. We gathered around the glowing dial, hearing telephones ringing 30 miles away. The popular vote was all for Clover, which was pure ignorance, we learned.
"The king is sorry," Deasy purred. "You should see his face, listeners. He's sad to be correct, to defeat the pretty lady. He's sorry to the tune of £500.
He then had Buck Hooper educate us. A certain Maslin map had been drawn in 1827. It included an inland sea, where in real life there were only blacks and desert. There was no inland sea, not ever. Yet because the madman's map was in the State Library of Victoria, so the inland sea existed, and our neighbour was judged to be correct. What tosh! There were bad fires at Belangaroo and Mount Macedon in early summer. The siren rang all day, and the hot wind blew from the north. During these few weeks, when you could smell the smoke inside the hairdressers, the tide of local opinion turned against our neighbour. The new judgment was freely expressed at the co-op and the post office. Buck Hooper was a good bloke. He'd had a great innings. Now let the lady win. Mr. Dunstan obviously did not follow the quiz show. As to the significance of Friday, he had no clue. He assumed there was a place for him at our dinner table, which would have been true on any other night when he might arrive with his plans, contracts, cash flow charts, spare parts inventories. Then I would be quiet as a mouse and listen to him talk, and I would fill his beer glass and not be disgusted by the froth which gathered in his fat moustache. When I demanded silence for nothing to lose, he was offended. Then, when he finally paid attention to the wireless, all he noticed was the prize money.
"You should have told me," he said. "You're living next door to a bank."
"We would never take advantage."
"That's correct," my husband said. "Jeez."
Dunstan looked at Titch as if he should get his wife in order.
"I'm only speaking from a cash flow point of view. We could always use a little more investment in the firm."
"We?" I thought, but my husband did not catch my eye. To be fair, Dunstan did us favours. He found us sponsors for the Red X trial. He released us an F.J. Holden demo model before the franchise was officially in hand. Titch used that demo to sell a record-breaking 17 vehicles. So thank you, Mr. Dunstan, I suppose. Although our success stressed our family to its sleepless limit. In those days, we had to drive 40 miles to General Motors and pick up the cars ourselves. If we were getting one vehicle, then okay. I would drive Titch down with a set of trade plates, and then we would both drive a vehicle back. To pick up two cars meant the train to Melbourne and an expensive taxi to GM. We could have used another driver in the family. On account of this, we missed the quiz show twice. We must have been somewhere in the industrial dark on Dynan Road, past the West Melbourne Stadium, when poor Willie Buck Hooper lost his throne. We did not even notice that it happened, only that he was suddenly in his back garden pulling down his chook house and stacking the wire and broken timber up the front. If we'd even read the paper, we would have known what happened to him. But we had our own worries, not least my sister claiming she'd been reduced to penury by me forcing her to sell the Geelong house. She said she now was forced to live in a caravan at Barwon Heads. Meanwhile, Miss Cloverdale had become the champion, and Willie Buck Hooper had been replaced by a new challenger. How could I live next door to him and not know? His heart was broken. His life was destroyed. But my main concern was that Ronnie fell out of the walnut tree and broke his arm. Also, Edith was trying for her Herald Learn to Swim certificate. We were sometimes forced to drive the new Holdens home over roads just sprayed with tar, a small enough thing until you understand the value of a new vehicle and the damage this risked. When we hit the wet tar, we crawled at 5 miles an hour, but not even this could save us from those little bits of bitumen sticking to the lower body, then hardening as we rushed down Anthony's cutting towards home. What a nightmare. It was all hands on deck and a rag and a bottle of eucalyptus oil for every one of them. I did not hesitate to rouse up our genius next door. Cough, cough, I cried, not understanding how that must have hurt. If he appeared reduced, I did not notice. I had a rag and a bottle of eucalyptus ready for him, and it was a presumption. I said, sorry, my husband would pay him for his time. We had to remove the tar before it set, under the wheel wells, hubcaps, rims, lower parts of doors. I worked on the front mudguard while Buck Hooper did the door.
That's cough-cough business, he said.
We're very proud, I said.
I'm dead in the water, Mrs. Bobbs.
And then Edith and Ronnie arrived, Ronnie in his plaster cast, crying because I had not picked him up and he was forbidden to walk home alone, and Edith had twisted his good arm and made him walk past the Catholics, the sale yards, the house full of illegal communists. I dried my son's tears and cooked the tea, and tried to help Edith with her long division. I returned to find Buck Hooper squatting on the grass, thoughtfully removing specks of bitumen. You're not going to let that woman beat you, Mr. Buck Hooper.
It's done, Mrs. Bobbs.
I thought, it's not too bad. She is his fiancée. Keep it in the family, I said. But I saw his face, and then the penny dropped. Dear God, I thought, why is life unfair? It was not for me to comfort him. That was why I brought Titch into it. After tea, the kids were clean and calm and happy, and Titch got off the phone and read to them, and they both snuggled up against him in Ronnie's tiny bed. Our neighbour was at home. I could see the light. I washed the dishes, then found my family all fast asleep like creatures in a burrow. I woke Titch and gave him a fiver and a bottle of beer, and sent him visiting next door. And I crept outside and stood in the doorway in the dark, and I could hear their voices, on and on. Then Ronnie was, Mum, Mum, Mum. He had wet his bed, poor sausage. When he was once more dry and sleeping, I fired up the copper in the laundry, and had all the time I needed to wash his sheets and jammers. Then put them through the mangle, hang them on the line, forget the dew and pray for sunshine. I was in bed with my face cream on by the time Titch lay down beside me.
"What a fascinating bloke," he said.
But he had learned absolutely nothing about his broken heart.
Chapter 19. Here's a knocking indeed. Knock, knock, knock. Who's there in the name of Beelzebub? Knock, knock. Who's there at the back door? It's me, called Mr. Bobsey. Why not the front door, then? My sad bachelor kitchen was piled with dead and dying dishes. The roasted leg of lamb. What shade of green was that? Knock, knock. Mr. Barkhuber? I saw the shadow. Birds, I thought. A tumbling troop of them. But no, dear God, I had a conjurer visiting. It's only me. Only? It was the marvellous midget juggling three oranges while he wedged a beer bottle between his tiny knees. Mr. Bobs, I said, please enter. Puss in Boots, he announced, pausing to present a single orange, then heading politely up the hall and into the front room, where he set the beer down before my private map. Up and down the street, all windows were open to catch a little breeze, but I was securely locked, and my front room was as humid as a henhouse. Titch Bobs, a gentleman, didn't even twitch his nose. He had sold cars to Irish bachelors with no time for housekeeping, that is. He was not in the judging business. He came to me as an angelic presence, luminous in his lemon-yellow pullover, dry and sweet as Johnson's baby powder. His cheeks were wide and freshly shaven, his hair smooth and black, and his eyes alive with mischief. I thought, he's like a girl, so pretty and light, the way he listens to you before you say a word about your failure. "Beer first," he said, "and oranges for pudding." I never drink without regret, but he had already lifted my heart. I found two clean glasses and a bottle opener, and he was immediately busy with his wallet. He offered a fiver, which I declined, and he used his hands with inscrutable good humour until finally, like a child at a birthday party, I found a £5 note behind my ear. "That's for good luck," he said. "You've had some bad luck, I hear." What had he heard? What did he know? That I knocked on Clover's door and found her in the company of an older woman eating my tuna casserole? No one moved. No one spoke. It was impossible to fully understand the situation except I was not liked or wanted. I later discovered that Clover had been a shop assistant, not a schoolteacher. But had I known it at the time, I would have loved her just the same. On the day Titch found me, I was still living amidst the ruins of Jacob Burckhardt and the civilization of the Renaissance in Italy. That exquisite phantom head was resting on my imaginary chest. I was slow to realize he had come into my house with no more motive than you might expect of a kind-hearted child of the Great Depression, ready to pay a homeless man to chop a stack of wood. He sat, companionably cross-legged, on my floor and poured two glasses. Why had he mentioned Puss in Boots? He didn't know. He didn't recognize Puss's famous lines, "Costantino, do not be cast down, for I will provide for your well-being and sustenance and for my own as well." And yet surely he wanted something. He was quiet in the way someone might be silent with desire. If he had been a girl, I would not have doubted what was up. But he was not a girl, and he did not wish to go home. And I finally understood that he had seen my map in progress and was waiting for me to tell him what it was. I had not touched my beer, and surely he saw that too, because he filled his own glass twice, but not before insisting I take an orange. And he watched while I peeled in the way my dear pastor always had, making a spiralling snake, an action which produced its own sweet homesickness. "We've all been down on our luck from time to time," he said. But he had become distracted, peering around my sweaty front room, which must have seemed a loony bin, with its interesting slogans, thoughts and quotes pinned against the blameless wall. For instance, a vast, obscure country. Words which Alessandro Spina had used to evoke the Italian view of his own bleeding Libya, but of course I had meant it in another way. Titch Bobs approached my map like a stalking cat, refilling his glass without looking down. My cartography included a dimension not normally suggested on flat paper. I mean the layers of time.